I told Marlon Brando I would take the necessary steps to appeal the no bail decision in the case of his son Christian, who was accused of killing his sister's boyfriend. After some small talk, Marlon said to me, "I'd like to see you alone for a moment." We walked into his bedroom and he said to me, "I found the bullet. I found the bullet." And he showed it to me.
That's the voice of William Kunstler. This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Mr. Kunstler's out with a new book, an autobiography. It's entitled My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Welcome to our construction-marred studios here. Thanks for coming to Chicago.
Charlie, I'm glad to be anywhere that's above ground.
Sheila Eisenberg, the co-author of your autobiography. Can you have a co-author on an autobiography?
Well, she's not really the co-author. She's the organizer. Sheila, I've known for many years. She's a writer, ex-newspaper woman, and she got the idea of doing this book. I dictated into a tape machine for what seemed to be years on end, and then Sheila would organize it and put it in such a fashion that it made sense. So I owe her a great deal of debt. Without her, the book would never have gotten off the ground.
She says in her introduction that if it serves a political purpose to fudge a little on the truth, you do. She says she checked key episodes that you related to her with other sources and selected from several versions the account that she decided strays least from the truth. Which leads me to the question of how much of what they read in your new book can your readers believe?
Oh, it's almost all true, but there are times when your memory slips, you can't remember a particular incident. I had situations where I had it in the wrong place, I had the wrong lawyers with me, I had the wrong results in some cases. I apologized in the book in advance for any of these, but when you're thinking back over almost 70 years of my life, even further back than that, it's difficult to remember everything. And with some of the cases where you didn't want to darken the memory of certain people, you know, I did take some liberties with the truth for that reason. But in the main, I think virtually everything is there. And of course, everything that's in court is checkable, so I couldn't stray very far from that.
You're 75?
It's going on 76.
Going on 76. Chicago plays a central role in your life. In the book, at least as you relate it, Chicago is sort of a centerpiece for your legal career. Tell our listeners about Chicago and what happened to you here, as many of them will remember, of course, but and how it changed your life.
Well, until I came to Chicago for the Chicago conspiracy trial, which started on September 23rd, 1969, 25 years ago, I was just another civil liberties lawyer. I had been working with Dr. King in the South. I was his, what he called his trial counsel, his special trial counsel, was the way he put it. I had represented Freedom Riders and Black Panthers and Congress of Racial Equality and so on, going to places like Birmingham and Selma and Jackson, Mississippi, and Albany, Georgia, Tallahassee, Florida, and so on. But I always believed in the court system that eventually we would win, that right would always show up somewhere along the appellate trail. In Chicago, I began to realize, as that trial wore on for 6 months, that that was really not so, that you wouldn't win all the time, that the system would use any dirty trick against you, that the system essentially was the enemy, and that my life, it was like my Rubicon, you know, and Caesar crossed the Rubicon. He changed his whole life experience. I changed my whole life experience when I crossed the Chicago River and went up into the Dirksen building on the 23rd floor into that hot chamber that was Julius Hoffman's courtroom.
The only other time that you and I have talked was at the time, the day when Judge Julius Hoffman, who oversaw that trial, died back in the 80s. Tell our listeners what you thought about the judge and about some of the other key figures in the trial.
In the beginning, I hated Judge Hoffman. We had the same birthday. He was 24 years older than I was. We were both born on July 7th, which I noticed in checking who's who. In fact, we used to fight over who had the biggest reference in who's who, and I won by three lines, as I remember. But later on, I found that he wasn't the real villain at all, that he was programmed deliberately by the government, because at one time, his secretary, Dorothy, sold tapes she had made of his dictation. She taped everything he said and also took it down in the steno book. And the tape showed that just before the trial, he was in his chambers when Cronkite came on comes on at then 6 o'clock here in Chicago, 7 in New York. And Cronkite is saying in the background, the defendants in the Chicago trial think the judge will be unfair to them. And two FBI agents are sitting with him as he's hearing this. And one says to him, "Judge, you're going to show him, aren't you?" And he said, "I'll show him who's unfair when I get them in the courtroom," and so on. So he was programmed deliberately to hate the defendants. They were all tall men in the main, except Jerry Rubin, but even Jerry was taller than he was. He was, as you remember, totally bald, looked like Mr. Magoo, sounded like Mr. Magoo, and was a martinet, supposed to control the courtroom tightly. And here were these people who had no respect for him and could upstage him and were smarter than he was. And so I think that his attitude with which he was programmed finally led to us winning that case.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. We're talking to William Kuntzler, attorney whose autobiography is just out, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. I know you've been asked about this before, but people often wonder how you could represent so many what most people would see as righteous individuals over the years, Martin Luther King, even the Chicago Eight, by some people's values, would be on the righteous side of civil liberties and justice, and then go on to represent, well, some more questionable figures. So you did some legal work for John Gotti.
I certainly did. I thought that what they did to John Gotti was a disgrace. I have no brief for John Gotti, except that the crimes he was accused of was killing 19 hoods, and I had a private thought he ought to get a civic award for that. But the point is, they took away his lawyer, who had successfully defended him on three prior criminal trials, Bruce Cutler. They had a sequestered anonymous jury. They got rid of one black woman from the jury on a very specious ground, who might have been favorable to him, and who had spotted some coaching going on during the questioning of one FBI agent. And I thought it was just dirty business with him, that it was so hot to get him. And I remember what Felix Frankfurter once said when he was on the Supreme Court. He said, "The history of civil rights in America is punctuated by cases where the defendants' last names ended in vowels." And it's true that in these pariah cases, the law develops. And so I thought that John Gotti was unjustly convicted. Whether he was guilty or not made absolutely no difference, that it was a dirty government operating against him.
Now, you have something in common with that, or at least purport in your book to have had something in common with that sort of treatment by the government. You say you've been harassed over the years by the government, the FBI. What's happened to you?
I share it with many people. I constantly audited 5 years in a row, which is totally unusual if you're going to have a random audit on the income tax. The FBI broke into my home and took my divorce files from my first marriage. They took my Rolodex. They confiscated my address book. I only learned about it when I saw an FBI report about Julian Bond in Georgia saying they had learned his secret telephone number from my address book. Then I knew they had taken that. They even put a direction finder on one of my friend's cars when he came to see me. And we sued them on that, and they paid us $20,000. We found the beeper they had put on the car, put it in a safe in our lawyer's office. They stole the safe, whole safe gone. But we had already settled, so we did get $20,000 from the Bureau.
When was that, roughly?
That was about 15 years ago.
Yeah, $20,000 went farther then than it does nowadays.
That's true. It seemed like a good settlement then. Today you wouldn't sneeze at it, but or you would sneeze at it.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. With the sound of construction noise in the background, they're building us a new studio, folks. Our guest is William Kuntzler. I'm Charlie Meyerson. What do you have to say about the state of law in America today, a state that you, among others, have had a large hand in shaping?
Well, the state of the law is that if they want to get someone, the pariahs, now it has to be, it's alleged Islamic terrorists now who are in that category. It used to be communists, it used to be Wobblies, Black Panthers. It changes from decade to decade. But the fact is, we have two kinds of law, one for those people and one for the rest of us. And that's always the way it's been in America, there's no question about it. The law is used politically in order to get certain people. And that's why a Gotti can lose his lawyer. And his co-defendant, Frank LoCascio, lost his on the very first day of that serious trial where they were facing life imprisonment. So you got to remember that happens. That's the truth of the matter. It's not a cynical approach. and you operate in that with that sure knowledge that they're going to use dirty tricks.
Has there been any change in the system with a capital S over your 30, 40 years in the law? For the better? For the worse?
For the worse, it's gotten more grotesque, less subtle than it used to be. For example, in New York, we have 8 state troopers accused of moving fingerprints by using scotch tape from a fingerprint card to a murder weapon, to a door handle, and so on. One was just convicted the other day and will be sentenced to jail very shortly. But I assume that goes on all the time, that they move fingerprints. The FBI always said, you can't move a fingerprint from one place to another. Now we know that the troopers were doing this regularly for years. So it can be done, and it is done. So you have dirty tricks all along the line.
What about the new celebrity? And maybe it's new, maybe it's not. I mean, you've enjoyed some of it yourself over the years. The celebrity accorded lawyers, things like court TV and you know, all the tabloid television that now is making a lot of trials around the nation, the stuff of, the Nightly Information Digest.
Charlie, trials have always been entertainment, even going back to the old English common law days when people waited for the assizes to come to town and went to see the trials. So, and we've had television dramas, movie dramas, you know, all based around lawyers, L.A. Law, Law and Order, and so on. In fact, I play a role on Law and Order in one of its upcoming productions. That gives lawyers one image, and then you have the fact that the public thinks all lawyers, you know, are money-grubbing, and most of them are, I think. Before we started to record here, I mentioned that there's a story going around in New York, what's the difference between a lawyer and a spermatozoa? And the answer is that a spermatozoa has one chance in 6 million to become a human being. That's my view of lawyers in general. I don't like the profession. They're mainly money grubbers, parasites, and I try to practice a different kind of law.
Well, since you are obviously trying to make the best of it, and I think a lot of people's estimation have made the best of it over the years, how can you say you don't like the profession? I could see where you'd say you don't like the people who practice it, that it's dominated by people who don't have much chance at all of becoming human.
Because the law is unfair itself.
But I mean, is the profession, does that indict? Does that indict the whole profession?
Not every single practitioner, of course not. But the profession as a whole is a parasitical one. The money paid lawyers is astronomical. How is anybody worth $400, $600 an hour? The billing practices are shoddy and greedy. And I've never really thought much of the profession as a profession because it is so parasitical. I'm talking mainly, of course, about the criminal law and also about the civil law where these vast fees are generated.
Well, what would you do to change the system? And is there anything that can be done to change this system?
Nothing can be done to change the system. All you can do with the system is fight it. But the fighting is important. The fact that there are people out there who will attack the system is very important. When they die or are no longer there, then you have the darkest of nights creeping upon us. I guess Nazi Germany would be an example of that, even though I'm not making any analogy between us and the Third Reich. But there've got to be people, and lawyers are in a prime position to do it, who understand how the system chews up human beings to fight it and to expose it.
Is your problem, is your objection to the American form of government, or are we talking in a broader sense about human nature in general?
No, it's any form of government. I would probably be saying the same thing in any country in the world. Where I could still speak. In the United States, since we have at least a First Amendment, partially kept vibrant because of corporations like this one and others who always fight First Amendment violations, we can speak out a lot more than we could in, say, another country. In England, for example, you can't speak out this much about pending trials as we can in the United States. So it isn't the fact that it's our form of government or any other form of government. All forms of government are oppressive. Lord Acton in England said, power corrupts, and that's true. It does corrupt.
And absolute power corrupts.
Corrupts absolutely. We're not in that stage yet. We're on the power corrupt stage.
This is Point of View, WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson talking to lawyer William Kunstler. His autobiography is just out. It's called My Life as a Radical Lawyer. You're, by my count, one of the few high-profile lawyers in this country not to be representing O.J. Simpson. Were you approached in any way to have a hand, to play a role in that?
No, they knew I wouldn't take a case like that. That's simply a wife-killing case, you know, which is against my politics, innocent or guilty. it's against my politics. I did pump very strongly to have Johnny Cochran become part of the team, and also to get rid of a lot of those lawyers that are on this team, because, as you know, O.J. Simpson is now divesting himself of his stocks in order to pay the lawyers. And since I think he's unconvictable, can never be convicted, that doesn't mean he'll be acquitted, but maybe a hung jury, because the only evidence is forensic, and it's not a direct case, it's a highly circumstantial case, but he's going to be without any money when he gets through.
So you think, again, I want to go over this, you don't think that he can be convicted?
No, he can't be convicted. We've reached the stage of the unconvictable, unique defendant, an icon. Never had one like this before. And I don't think you're going to get 12 jurors, particularly if there are third world people on the jury, as there will be. I don't think you're going to get 12 jurors to agree on a unanimous verdict of guilty.
You think he's just going to walk away from all this eventually?
Well, he's going to have a hung jury, and there'll be a second trial. Or maybe there'll be some sort of a deal. I don't know. Shapiro, that's Shapiro's fort, is dealing. But I don't know. Or maybe they won't try it again. But I don't think they can convict him. And if they ask for the death penalty, I would be even more certain he'd be acquitted.
And of course, they said they're not going to.
Well, that's really doing it to try to save a jury verdict.
Yeah. Any other comments on the way this has been handled by prosecution or defense?
I think they both seem somewhat inept to me. Too many lawyers on his side gives the impression of that Marcia Clark is like David and they're like Goliath. A lot of hoopla is going on, the 800 number and so on, and whispers about someone else who committed the crime and secret witnesses and so on. But if it weren't for OJ's name, this would be a routine case you never hear of.
Talking about legal strategy, I want to go back to the Chicago conspiracy trial. In your book, you mentioned how that trial, in addition to changing your fundamental philosophical outlook, brought a change in the way you approached court, the way you, as a lawyer, represented your clients and dealt with the authorities, the judge and the prosecution. Tell us about that.
Oh, it changed me totally. For example, I finished a case some years ago, the killing of a state trooper. This is long after Chicago, in New Jersey. And the clients, there were two clients, said to me, "We don't stand for the judge. And we would like you not to stand for the judge. Because if you stand and we don't stand, it looks peculiar that you think we're wrong." So we refused to stand for the judge, who threatened to hold us in contempt, which he never did. And by the way, just as an aside, he was just convicted and sentenced to jail, that particular judge. But I would never have done that before Chicago. I never knew what it was to really fight until I watched Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Dave Dellinger, Hayden, and so on. Fight in the courtroom, do things that would make the jury understand that they were being persecuted, bringing in a birthday cake for Bobby Seale, a Viet Cong flag on their table, standing up and protesting the binding and gagging of Bobby Seale in the courtroom. There were so many things they did that showed they were fighting. They weren't going to sit there like bumps on a log and be railroaded. And the net result was they won.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Myers, and our guest is William Kuntzler, lawyer whose autobiography is just out and is entitled My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Your resume, the book itself, read like an outline of the politics of the last four decades, the Rosenbergs, Jack Ruby, Martin Luther King, the Chicago Seven, Attica, Wounded Knee, World Trade Center bombing. Have I left out anything?
You're tiring me out now. Did I do all of that?
I'm getting exhausted just reading it. What are you most proud of? What have you achieved that you think is the pinnacle of your career so far?
This is a very easy question to answer, because I tried a case called the Washington, D.C. school case, in which we got rid of a track system that was used to keep blacks from going to college. And since blacks made up 93% of the Washington school population, that meant that hundreds and thousands of black kids could never go to college because they were shunted in tracks 3 and 4, which were domestic science, auto mechanics, and so on the basis of a Stanford-Binet IQ test, which was modeled on a white background. For example, they were in third grade. This was all decided. They were asked to look at a picture of four men, and the question was asked, which one of these daddies is going to work? One was in overalls, one was in a business suit, one was playing a tennis costume, one was in a bathing suit. And most of the black kids said the man in the overalls, because that was their background. All the whites said the man in the business suit, and that's the right answer. So they got marked right for that, wrong for the blacks, and that's how they judged whether they were fit to go into tracks 1 and 2. And I think now, since we got rid of that, the judge enjoined the use of it, I think there are hundreds and thousands of black kids in D.C. who have been able to go to college because of that case. I'll never know who they are, and they'll never know my name, probably, but I think that case did it.
What year was that?
That was 1966 to 67.
What are your biggest regrets, professionally or otherwise?
I have one regret, that I was eased out of the case of Philip Berrigan and others who were accused of a conspiracy to kidnap Henry Kissinger and hold him for the ransom being the end of the Vietnamese war or American involvement in Vietnam. And some of the defendants thought I was too radical or what have you, some of the lawyers too. So I was squeezed out of that case, even though Phil and Dan had been my clients a year or two earlier when they burnt draft records at Catonsville. My grandson is named after them, Daniel Philip Goldman. They were blessed by these two priests when they were in jail. And my grandchildren, who are twins, were 6 months old. Very close relationship. But I'll tell you, 2 or 3 days after I was squeezed out, all of a sudden, there was another new case, another exciting place to go, and it completely slipped my mind. But I always resented not being in that case, which, as you know, resulted also in a victory in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
When have you been the most frightened in your career?
In Attica. When the,
tell our listeners
when
about
the inmates it. Announced they were going to cut our throats.
1971, right?
1971. Just again, you know, 23 years ago. There I was scared stiff, even more scared than I was in the Southwest Pacific during World War II. And the authorities had sent in a note saying we agreed with the authorities that they should surrender in the yard. You know, they had held out 4 days, that they should surrender. And so I went in there, and we were told that the note had gone in, even though the authorities said they wouldn't send it in. They wanted us killed, so they had an excuse for retaking the yard. When they said to me, we're going to cut your throat, boy, my legs wanted to move. But they gave us, they were decent, they gave us a chance to explain. I was with Tom Wicker of the Times and I think six other of the observers who were left, and they gave us a chance to explain, and they didn't cut any throats.
What would you most like to achieve in for the remainder of your career, which we hope goes on for years and years?
I want to go and do what I'm doing until one day I slip down a lectern after an impassioned summation and die in the courtroom. My only regret with it, I won't be able to see the press that is evoked by that situation.
And what are you working on now?
About a dozen different cases. We just were kicked out, as you know, of, maybe you don't, of the World Trade Center conspiracy case in order to get us out. The way they did John Gotti, they have now done myself and Ronald Kuby, my partner, who were the only non-government paid attorneys in the case. But we're working on a number of murder cases, a number of appeals. We're exhuming bodies to prove that Reagan and company made an arrangement with the Iranians to have the release of the Tehran embassy car after the election, not before. There's a lot of things in the offing.
We'll be watching, listening for them. Our guest at Point of View on WNUA 95.5 has been William Kunstler, lawyer to social outcasts, political radicals. His new book is an autobiography, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, 2250 from Birch Lane Press. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for listening.